Hi, everyone. This is Drew. Hey, we've been providing authentic, in-depth interviews about spiritual stuff for over 15 years now. But there's a change a-coming. Now, if you've already heard this message, just skip ahead to the interview. But if it's the first time, will you do me a solid and hang with me for just a few minutes? You know, about 15 years ago, when I moved back to Canada after being a pastor in Australia, I realized that there was no way in the world that I should be in any form of spiritual leadership for so many reasons. But I think the main reason was because I've always struggled with belief. Now look, I'm still incredibly curious about what gets people through the night, and more often than not, it ends up being someone's faith or spiritual beliefs. So I created a radio show that set out to interview cultural icons and religious leaders, celebrities, and, you know, everyday people about what they believe, but more importantly, why they believe. And along the way, my faith has gone from simply being a noun to a verb. And I've also discovered that doubt is actually more compatible with faith than certainty. In other words, I no longer feel guilty about my doubts. So thanks for tuning in as I interview all sorts of people about all sorts of faith. I hope their journeys, no matter what they believe, have had a profound impact on your journey, and that your faith has also become a verb. Because, in my opinion, being spiritually neutral, that's an oxymoron. By the way, thanks to Joy Radio for letting me broadcast all of this spiritual tension, because I think this tension is where real faith is cultivated, in between hope and doubt. Together, Joy Radio and my team have created Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. Okay, that's all the kumbaya stuff. Now here's the ask. And I know, I'm the same. I'm rolling my eyes as well. It's kind of like when Wikipedia puts up that note asking for money every once in a while, or when your local publicly supported radio or TV station does one of those annoying fundraising campaigns. I completely ignore them as well. I guess my thinking is that an organization like Wikipedia probably makes enough money anyway. Or, worst case scenario, they'll find enough people to support them. But please, if you're a regular listener of the Drew Marshall Show, man, I kind of really need your help. The station I've been broadcasting on for over 15 years has never actually paid me to do the show. Instead, they've let me try to sell advertising. But that's been a little more of a challenge than I imagined, because religious advertisers sometimes feel that my show isn't religious enough, and quote-unquote normal advertisers sometimes feel like we're too religious. So it's been a long, crazy uphill battle over the last 15 years just trying to make a living, living in that tension. Trust me, I'm struggling to pay the bills just like you are. But as we start season 16 in September, we just found out something huge. Joy Radio will now be charging me for airtime. Now, surprisingly, this is standard practice for a lot of radio shows, especially on faith-based radio stations. But the bottom line is that there will now be an astounding 30% hike in costs for me. Ugh. Airtime's not cheap, and to be honest, finding even more advertisers to cover that 30%, it's kind of freaking me out a little bit. So, maybe you've been downloading our podcast and don't actually have to listen to the advertising that our radio audience listens to during each live four-hour show. And by the way, just so you know, any advertising we've actually been able to find has only ever covered about 70% of our annual costs. So the ask is this: would you consider going from being just a consumer of our show to becoming a patron? Would you mind throwing us a few bucks each month just to help us cover that 30% difference? Heck, you know what? If we can get enough patrons supporting the Drew Marshall Show, we could feasibly get to the point where we become completely listener-supported without the need of any advertising. Now that would be amazing. So, a patron. What? What is that? Well, a patron was the kind of person who allowed Shakespeare to create a product that also spoke of similar life tensions. Tensions that most people were living, but few were admitting to each other. A patron is someone who appreciates the product they're consuming so much that they're willing to throw a few bucks towards securing a future for that product. Now, just FYI, there are over 100,000 creators being supported by patrons through Patreon right now. So this is becoming the new way to say thank you to those who create the products we all consume online. Now, I fully understand the fact that I'm certainly no Shakespeare. I get that. But someone said to me recently that they would absolutely support our show monthly. Methinks there might be others. Yea, but maybe not. Let's findeth outeth. Yeah, I should never do that again. So here's the ask. Will you support the Drew Marshall Show $4 or $9 or $19 a month? By the way, that's American coin. So sorry to everyone listening from parts of the world whose currency is kind of struggling against the US dollar. But here's the other thing. If you cannot afford it, Please, obviously, no worries. When I used to be a pastor, I would say, hey, when the offering plate goes around, if you can give, give. If you need some, take some. So just take our show for free, guilt-free, if you can't afford $4 a month. Please. Because the conversations we're having in the Drew Marshall Show, I honestly feel need to be heard no matter what. Look, my dream is to have the most brutally authentic spiritual talk show in the world. And here's why that's important to me. Because I really believe that a key ingredient to spiritual growth is authenticity. And the tension of a brutally authentic spiritual talk show makes some people feel uncomfortable. But as far as I'm concerned, faith is messy and it can be brutal. But instead of looking the other way, our show dares to stare back into this beautiful mess called faith. So thanks for your support as we continue to live in the tension between belief and doubt, and while trying not to take ourselves too seriously along the way. Hopefully you'll laugh, sometimes you'll cringe, but no matter what, please know that what I care about most is brutally authentic spirituality. Now, go drink the Kool-Aid, will ya?
Cult reference!
And become a patron of The Drew Marshall Show. Thanks for listening. Who are you? You see what we did there? A little theme song happening. So beautiful. We're into the Enneagram segment of the Drew Marshall Show. We've been talking about the Enneagram for the last 3 weeks during each Saturday in July. You know, for thousands of years, spiritual teachers from many different traditions have reminded us of the richness of the human spirit and its potentials. But without real self-knowledge, it's kind of not possible to awaken the deeper truths of the soul or to sustain whatever degree of realization we have attained. One of the most powerful tools for understanding ourselves and others is the Enneagram. It's an ancient symbol of unity and diversity, change and transformation. And this is the last week in our four-part series in July where we explore the personal transformation tool that has helped me more than any other thing out there. And I've read a lot, listened to a lot, attended a lot of seminars and courses and all this kind of stuff, because if anybody is aware of what a jerk they are, it is me. And I've gone to, where do I sign up? How do I de-jerk myself? That just sounded weird. So this week on the Drew Marshall Show, we are again chatting with Gail Scott. And Gail is a master Enneagram teacher and consultant, founder and director of the Enneagram Mystery School in Boulder, Colorado. Gail, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself? I was wondering, where are you today on the jerkometer between 1
the
and 100?
The jerkometer. I love that. Man, I think I've been actually kind of up and down, because you don't really know how you don't know how much you've transformed until trials and tribulations come, or triggers. Trials, tribulations, or triggers come your way.
Yes.
And then it's, do you react the same way as you have for most of your life? Or maybe you react the same way, but then recover quicker. Or maybe you don't react the same way at all. And those things are slowly happening to me. It is like steering the Titanic, de-jerking yourself, right?
Yes, but you're right. The response, the reaction time changes. It gets quicker and quicker until at some point you're doing the same thing over and over, but you're noticing it and, you know, knocking yourself on the forehead sooner and sooner. And eventually you notice it right in the middle of it, just as you're about to step in the big pile of poop. You notice what you're doing. And then a little, you know, while later, if you continue the work and trying to be conscious about it, you can actually stop yourself before you make that step.
So interesting you said that, because I was going through some pictures last night of some of my Camino pictures, and and I have a picture of my footprint in a pile of cow poo.
Uh-huh.
And what has happened on the Camino is you spend the entire time in this Camino looking for the signs.
Yes.
The yellow arrows to tell you which way to go. You're looking for the signs, and you're looking for the signs, and you're looking for the signs. And if you spend your entire journey looking for signs, you eventually step in poop.
I imagine quite often.
Yes. And so are you following with the allegory we're using here? I have no idea if this is making any sense. All right, listen, let's just do that quick summary again. What do you want to say before we start explaining the final three types, the investigator, the loyalist, and the enthusiast? What do you want to say before we get into the final three types, Gail?
Well, I think I should say that these final three types, the 5, the 6, and the 7, comprise the third center of intelligence, which is the head center or the thinking center. If you remember, we started with 8, 9, and 1, and they're in the body or the belly or the gut center. The 2, 3, and 4, last week we talked about them, they're in the heart center, the feeling center. So today we're talking about 5, 6, and 7, who are In the head center. And what does that mean? It means the head center is the function that the ego has formed around most rigidly is thinking. And the thinking is the component of the psyche that, in fact, is most compromised if you are one of these types. But what these types are after, it's a need for, they're looking for security and guidance. They're looking for a good orientation to enhance their ability to operate in the world. And the reason for this is that the 5, 6, and 7 have lost touch with that aspect of our true nature that we call in spiritual traditions quiet mind. And quiet mind, as you know, is the source of our inner gnosis, our inner direct knowing, that inner knowing, that guidance that allows us to perceive reality as it really is. It's not about just accepting something that you've been told. It's not thinking about something. It's not about having an opinion. No, it's about the real knowing that's happening right now, only now, in the here and now, in this moment. So our inner gnosis enables us to be receptive to that inner wisdom that can guide our actions. It's an inspiration. It's a like a spontaneous and exact knowing. And we can't get at it through any kind of strenuous thinking processes. It becomes available through this deep letting go and being okay with not knowing, and then trusting, you know, trusting within quiet mind that stillness to receive. And of course, all contemplative prayer and meditation aims to focus and quiet the mind for just this purpose, so we can be open to our inner knowing, our inner gnosis. But 5, 6, and 7, as we'll see, for different reasons, have a lot of difficulty with monkey mind. With trying to keep the mind quiet down. And they're asking these questions all the time. What's going to happen to me? What do I do? How do I move into the future? Where's my security? How am I going to cope? How do I make the right choices? Basically, they're all asking, you know, how do I move into the future? What do I do now? So they have a lot of trouble getting their minds to simmer down so that they could actually feel supported by that inner knowing. And when this is blocked, they have that underlying feeling, 5, 6, 7, of fear or anxiety. So we call these the fear types. You might remember the 2, 3, and 4, the river that runs through it, I said, was shame and hurt. And for the 8, 9, and 1, it was fear and rage. But for the 5, I'm sorry, not fear and rage, anger and rage. But for the 5, 6, 7, these are the fear types, and that fear and anxiety is the river that runs through it, because they don't know which way to go and you know, who to listen to and what to do.
Okay. As we like to do every time we've had you on the show, Gail, I know enough about the Christian tribe to know that there are some Christians who are going to hear Enneagram, and they're going to think, wait, are you listening to Enya burning incense and weighing grand, I don't know whether, you know,
worshiping Satan.
Yeah, you know, there are people that say, "Oh, all I need is everything I need in life is just in the Bible. I don't need anything else to inform me. I just need what's in the Bible." And anything that's not of the Bible, we need to be leery about. And anything that has pointy corners and triangles and stuff is from Satan or witchcraft or whatever. And you've got a symbol on the Enneagram that, you know, some Christians go, "Whoa, what's that?" So can you help Christians chill when it comes to the Enneagram?
Well, I think at this point, I think that you're in a very good position to help people chill when it comes to the Enneagram, because you've been looking into it long enough now.
Yeah.
Certainly, it draws from all the wisdom traditions, including Christianity and Judaism. One of the things that we'll talk about for each of the 9 types is what we call the passion or the sin of each type, which comes from, of course, the Christian monastics, the Desert Fathers, Desert Elders, who came up with originally 9 original sins or capital sins, different names for it, which were later reduced to 7, but originally it was 9. And there are many, many, many traces of early Christian tradition and beliefs that have made their way into the Enneagram. It's really, to me, it seems like, I think of it as a really ancient template of reality that actually, in a way, predates formal religion or the writings of religion. But the truths that are contained in this symbol or in this system you see throughout Christianity and Judaism and other religions.
Okay, so here's my brief spin on this.
Okay.
I am deathly allergic to woo-woo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I still have the spiritual gift of judgmentalism and sarcasm, and it doesn't help my relationships very much. But when it's woo-woo, when it's just stuff that I can't actually, there's no handlebars to grab onto, I still have a little bit of, I think, some discernment. Just because I listen to people who believe other things doesn't mean I believe those things. We talked about that earlier in the show. And I still think I have some discernment that can look at something and go, really? And now, sometimes that ends up being just judgmentalism. But then when I lean in a little further, if I'm still going, really? This is just too, like the horoscope stuff. I don't have the time of day for that. I just don't. I'm sorry if you're a horoscoper. I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, when I had Sylvia Brown on the show, we talked about psychic stuff. It's woo-woo. There's nothing woo-woo about the Enneagram except the name and the symbol. That's it.
Well, I don't think the name is actually woo-woo. Ennea is the Greek word for nine.
And she's a good singer.
And gram means diagram or drawing or symbol. So it's really
9 points on the symbol. That's it.
On a 9-pointed symbol. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, let's get into it. Let's go with
type 5, the investigator.
The intense cerebral type, perceptive, innovative, secretive, and isolated. Tim and I both think we know someone like this. We're going to throw him under the bus right now. And we're not supposed to type anybody else, but we're going to do it anyway. Guard!
Yeah.
Okay, go.
All right. So the type 5 we call the investigator. Some other names are the innovator or the specialist or the expert or sometimes the radical. And this is the intense cerebral type. They're very perceptive people. They tend to be quite innovative, a lot of original thinking. They also tend to be often provocative and eccentric types. And then at what we call down the levels or less healthy, they become secretive and isolated. But I'd like to talk for a minute about the real quality of each type. The real quality for type 5 is what we call real illumination, which is to say that the 5 experiences unity with divine as being at one with clarity, with illumination, with understanding, the illumination of our own experience. It's that, like, when we're grounded in our bodies, when we're present, when we're aware, our consciousness becomes like this clear light illuminating everything. It's like this pristine, precise light without a source. And there's a consciousness, there's a knowingness that is illuminating everything, and I feel that I am one with this. I'm part of this clarity of recognition. And the 5, if I'm a 5, I absolutely live for this sense of illumination. It helps me know that there's inherent structure and pattern and dynamism to reality. There's a kind of fluidity, and I'm part of it, and I'm the ultimate truth of reality. That aha moment, you know, that sacred recognition of everything that is. However, when, as 5, you know, when I'm cut off from that, I feel lost, I can't know anything, the universe is like dark and incomprehensible, there's nothing known or knowing, and in particular, I, as a little being, I feel incompetent and deficient and disconnected from everything that's knowable, everything that's recognizable. I feel I'm in the dark and just, you know, lost in chaos. So this leads to the basic fear of the type 5. The basic fear that underlies everything is the fear of having no ability to know what's real or true and to be lost in ignorance and senselessness, which makes me feel helpless, useless, incapable, incompetent. So the opposite of that, the basic desire, what the type 5 is after, is I want to understand reality. I want to uncover the essence of things. I want to become capable and competent to be able to do. And in particular, I want, as a 5, I want to master a particular body of knowledge and skill, to explore reality, usually way out on the edges where no one has been, to have something to bring back to the table, something to contribute to my tribe. So I'm looking for mastery of something to help me overcome my isolation and join the human race.
So throw out some examples of notable people that would be nines. Or, sorry, that would be fives, the investigator.
Five. Sure. Well, some real iconic people would be Albert Einstein, for instance, who there's all kinds of wonderful five-ish stories about him. Like, when he was 5 years old, he looked at a compass, right? A little five-year-old kid. And he realized through his five-ish mind that there was a magnetic force behind everything, you know, just from picking up a compass, and then, you know, the rest is history. Mm-hmm. Another is
I found out about that when I licked the dumpster behind the school during winter.
What did you find out?
That your tongue freezes.
Oh, that's good too.
Magnets.
The late great Stephen Hawking, of course, another five, who, you know, went to the outer reaches of, you know, what we know about, you know, the universe. An artist, Vincent van Gogh, George O'Keefe, one of my favorites, Salvador Dali. There's often that sort of, I don't know, uniqueness or eclectic or sort of weirdness in Type 5 art. Hmm. Also, fives are quite preeminent in the IT world these days. They've kind of come into their own, you know, via Bill Gates is a five, Mark Zuckerberg is a five. In the spiritual realm, if you're familiar with Eckhart Tolle, he's a classic five. He has that particular five sort of character of, he sort of looks like a little garden gnome sometimes, you know. It has that sort of quirky...
Hold on. Eckhart Tolle looks like a garden gnome. I just figured that out.
Does he use Travelocity?
Oh, that's funny. That's funny, Tim.
And then also a lot of, actually I'm thinking now of the film directors, Canadians, like Stanley Kubrick, right, 2001. David Cronenberg, who does all those scary, you know, movies. Tim Burton, David Lynch. And if you're familiar with the cartoons, the books called The Far Side by Gary Larson.
Oh, he is totally a five, yeah.
He's a total five character. And fives, their orientation, they feel like they're reporting from the far side. In other words, they don't feel like fives don't feel that they're in the center of things. They feel like this is such an alien planet. Most five, last week I said that a lot of type four people feel like they were left on the wrong doorstep.
Yep.
Switched at birth. Well, type five feel like aliens. They feel like they were left in the wrong planet, really.
You know, maybe Kirk Cameron is a five because he was left behind.
Oh! With lots of bananas.
Sorry, inside Christian joke. Okay, go ahead. Yes?
Yeah, so that's quite a few examples there. I think you
that's good.
The gist. So they want to know, these are intense people. They have like a penetrating, incredibly perceptive mind, and they do not accept, you know, common what the ordinary person thinks. They want to see beneath the surface. They want to know if something makes sense to them. You know, is it really true? So when they're healthy, they can really accomplish a lot. I would say a lot of, well, certainly science, but also other fields, has been advanced, you know, over the centuries by these pioneering visionaries who are profound and they have depth because they're naturally curious, they're fascinated, they're just enraptured with, you know, how do things work? What is this world about? So they're always asking, you know, why, and they can be revolutionary in their exploration. And they are extremely innovative and original. As I said, they don't go down paths that have already been, you know, overtrod. They're looking for their own, not to be unique, but they want to go where no one has explored before to really come back with something new and fresh. And they have this unconstrained sort of creativity. Like, they're often on the leading edge of innovation. And they're always saying, like, well, you know, why do it that way? Let's try it, you know, a new way. Why do I always do it the way it's been done?
Yeah.
You know, if the instrument will play differently, you know, what do we learn about sound? So musicians like John Cage or Laurie Anderson or Brian Eno or Glenn Gould, those people. So fives tend to see things and make connections that the rest of us just miss. They have a kind of perceptive quality often, and they love to tinker around. You know, like, they'll take an alarm clock apart as a little kid, you know, see how it works. And they're usually uncompromisingly honest. They're seekers of truth, of objective truth in the world. You know, they want to know what's going on. They prefer generally to working alone, like they want to be just, you know, out there, leave me alone to do my own work.
Yeah, because they have a beautiful mind.
That's right, the beautiful mind, the Russell Crowe movie where he played John Nash. He was this brilliant but asocial, as five with six wings often are, a mathematical genius. He was a Nobel laureate in economics. And he had those qualities of intensity, that penetrating, perceptive, you know, wanting to look, you know, beneath. Oh, and he also had a particular, what did they call it with him? Fives often have a, because their filters are wide open, they often have, they have this filter that controls the rate of sensory impulses going into the brain called the reticular activating system. And fives have a wide open system, so there's too much information coming in all the time. So they can easily feel like there's a sensory overload. They can be overwhelmed by things. So they withdraw. They're a withdrawing type, and they will withdraw.
Yeah.
They need a lot of downtime. They need, more than any other type, fives need alone time because they have to recharge their batteries.
Okay, that is type 5, the investigator. By the way, Gord was listening when I threw him under the bus, and Gord sent me a text, and he said, "Nope, not me. Did the test last week. Ha." So this goes to show you, you don't type other people, Tim.
Right.
Did he say what he was?
I did. I asked him. He said, "Gonna keep you guessing for a while. Maybe you should make it a radio contest." What type is Gord? Okay. So up next is the loyalist, type 6, and type 7, the enthusiast. I just want to ask our co-host here before we go to a commercial break. Bridget.
Yes.
We need a microphone for Bridget. Bridget, have you done the Enneagram test?
Why, Drew, yes, I have.
And what are you?
I am a...
what's your number one?
A helper.
A helper? Number two?
And then an 8 and a 3.
An 8 and a 3?
They're like the same.
Okay.
What's 8? What's 3?
8. One was an achiever. One of
3 is achiever.
3 is achiever.
Yeah.
And we couldn't figure out what 8 was.
No, 8 is the peacemaker. Easygoing, self-effacing,
no,
receptive.
Sorry,
8 is the challenger. Pardon me, pardon me.
Yep.
The powerful, dominating type?
Yep, that's me.
You're not. Really?
So just let me reiterate that. You might have a high scores in several types, but each person has one dominant personality type, and you have that your entire life. So look at your top 3 scores, but one of them is going to be you.
By the way, Gord just sent me another text saying, "Yes, that does sound a lot like me, though, even more than my actual type, maybe." So getting your type right is important. And might I suggest that after you go to the EnneagramInstitute.com and pay $12 American, this is not a commercial, this is just what you need to do. You can do the free one if you can't afford the $12, but if you could do the $12 one, it's like bigger and better and you get more feedback. And it types you, then can I suggest getting a hold of this book? It's a little pricey, I think, because it's big. What's the book called again, Gail?
The Wisdom of the Enneagram by Don Riso, R-I-S-O, and Russ Hudson.
And Gail has nothing to do with that book. She's not getting you know, money for that kind of thing. She just has worked with these guys forever, and I have this book. It is phenomenal. Really, really, really good stuff. And it is important let me just ask you this, Gail. How can you be sure that your type is your type?
You just keep reading about it, and it will feel more and more or less and less true.
Right, so it's like OJ putting on the glove. That was a horrible example.
I don't know what that has to
do with that. Well, it's either going to fit or it's not, right?
That's right, it's going to fit or it's not.
Okay.
And then you keep looking until... But, however, I would say... You know, if that particular book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, is so reader-friendly and so simple but so thorough and so detailed that if you read the chapters on the types, chances are very high that you will find yourself, and then you just keep going a little deeper.
Good stuff. Good stuff. All right, a very short commercial break on our show. Just want to say a quick shout-out to people who are watching on Facebook Live. Brian Knights, who's a mutual friend of Tim and I, said, "Tim is awesome," so it doesn't really count because it's someone we know. Faye Collins, love the intern interviews. Chantel Desloges is waving. That would be Chantel Desloges. And Audra Holt says, "Hi, Drew." So, hi, Audra Holt. There you go. There's a few comments. Gail, type 6, the loyalist. The committed, security-oriented, engaging, responsible, anxious, and suspicious type.
Yes. That's right. We also call type 6 the loyalist, the pathfinder. In business, we call the 6 the troubleshooter. So the real quality for the type 6 people is awakeness and inner guidance. So the 6 experiences that unity with the divine essence as being a quality, a particular quality of awakeness, the awake mind with consciousness awakened to itself. And we know that it's the awakeness that leads us, you know, directly, steadfastly, into contact with that sense of inner guidance. And when we have that beautiful, brilliant awakeness, without efforting, you know, our path just appears before us. You know, we see, we know what to do, we know what's needed next. In traditional religious, we call this walking in faith. It means knowing the direct presence of the divine, of the support for me now and each and every moment of my life. So when we're awake, there is this joyful confidence, a confidence in reality and truth and presence and God, and I know that I'm going to be okay no matter what. You know, I can be facing death, but I know, you know, it's going to be all right. So the type 6 personality is really about both things. It's about awareness and the sense of the support of presence and feeling that I'm never without it. It's also about fulfilling what we're here to fulfill. It's about walking our journey. It's about living as spiritual warriors, you know, living what we're here to do with love and grace and commitment. Now, when I feel cut off from this, when I lose presence, instead of being awake to all this amazing support and guidance that is me, I feel totally lost, disoriented, abandoned, and forsaken. It's like there's no sense of solid ground. There's nothing to support me. It's like this hole opens up beneath my feet, and I'm confused, and I'm wondering, you know, where do I go? Who can I trust? I feel really frantic and shaky and vulnerable and full of that underlying, you know, anxiety and fear. And the basic fear for the 6 is of being lost without orientation, having no support, being unable to survive on my own. So my desire is to find that real ground, that trustworthy orientation, so that I can be secure and supported. I want to have something beneath my feet. So one of the reasons that we call the 6 the loyalist is because I'm looking for things when I'm in ego fixation. I'm looking for things outside of myself rather than trusting that inner knowing. Looking for things outside of myself for support. And I will often, you know, attach myself to people, ideas, belief systems, philosophies, religions, anything that works for me, that helps me feel like, okay, somebody has gone down this path before me, they know about it, they've written about it. If I join that, believe in that, I'll feel both the sense of security from being in a group, but also just that sense of having something beneath my feet, a home, someplace I belong.
Gail, the people that I know that are loyalists, it's almost like, well, hold on, every person, I'm not going to say this right, I'm going to get in trouble again, Gail.
Blame it on Gord.
We should print up shirts that say that,
yeah,
blame it on
Gord's
Gord.
Fault.
The people that I know that are loyalists are some of the most bipolar people I know. They can be so freaking kumbaya and chill and just beautiful and loyal, you know, committed to get rid of it. But then they can also be kind of like just wound about stuff.
Well, so, okay. Yes, and of course, again, this has everything to do with how healthy you are within your own type. However, you have hit on something important because it is part of the, shall we say, fingerprint of the type 6, and it does lead to a lot of confusion, that just about anything that you can, that there's a certain contrariness, just about anything that you can say about a 6, the opposite of that at some point becomes true. Like, they can be, you know, very loyal and trustworthy, but they can also be undermining and flaky. They're, I would say, the most reactive type because they're always reacting to a sense of fear and abandonment,
right,
and not knowing what to do. And so because they're reactive, it's not really mood so much, but their mental activity can be all over the place. Now, when they're very healthy, 6s are just extremely friendly and engaging and disarming. And there's a sense that, you know, I'm the same as you. I'm just a regular gal, regular guy, you know, very friendly. And it's easy for them to disarm people who they see as a potential threat, because, you know, if we're friends, then we're not enemies, and you won't try to hurt me. And so sixes often become talk show hosts. You know, they're just really good at, like, Ellen DeGeneres, I think, is a good example of a healthy six. Talk show host. It's like everybody that comes on her show, we're all the same. Doesn't matter if you're the president or the prime minister or an actor or, you know, whoever it is, we all dance together, we're all the same. And it sort of levels the playing field and helps you feel like, well, you know, just one of us.
Obviously, I have to ask you, Gail.
Yep.
Do fours make good talk show hosts?
Yes, but there's a very different style. So right. The style of talk show host is different for every type. Ellen DeGeneres is a good example of the style that, as I said, just sort of we're all in this together.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Also healthy sixes, I want to say they can sort of look like type ones here, but they're very responsible and earnest. Like what's really important to a healthy six is showing up, you know, doing my job, doing my duty, you know, doing the right thing, being a good steward, you know, you can count on me, my word is my bond. And so they're very, you know, can-do, responsible. They can certainly be in positions of leadership. However, they're also just as happy often allowing other people, perhaps type eights, you know, who have more natural leadership, you know, abilities and skills, to go to the top. But sixes are very, very tuned into what I would call, they have a social intelligence, which is to say their orientation is that they look to the group, to the clan, to the tribe, right? And sixes, they really understand that in order to accomplish something, we have to come together. We have to work together. They understand certainly that there is strength in numbers, there's safety in numbers, and six is the one who will pull the tribe together. You know, they have these quite amazing, usually, if they're healthy, group organization skills, right? Now, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily group people who are always going to join groups, but they understand at a very deep level the power of organizing people, of cooperating, of delegating responsibility, of getting along and trying to get something established so we have something to work with. Mm-hmm. Now, not all sixes are social. Some of them are hermits, but they understand the necessity of some kind of coordinated action. And therefore, they often do well in the military or in the police force or become firemen. It's like they understand, you know, chains of command.
Okay.
And organizational structure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some examples of notable sixes, please. Loyalists.
Okay, in what field? you know, who's been in the news recently? So Diana, the Princess of Wales, was a six. She was what we call a phobic six. What was she looking for? She wanted her place. She wanted to be part of the family. She wanted to be accepted. And she was very, just very earnest about trying to do what was expected to her, you know, be part of the royal family. But it didn't quite work out for all the reasons that we know. And I think it made her, you know, pretty crazy.
Camilla!
She didn't have that place. Now, interestingly, her younger son, Prince Harry, the one that just got married, he's also a six. And when people talk, you hear a lot, people talk about, wow, he's, you know, he's got his mother's personality. He's so much like her. He's so friendly. He's like a real person. He doesn't take on airs. You know, they called her the people's princess, and they call him the people's prince because he's one of us. Right, he doesn't take on that hoity-toity, you know, the royals kind of thing.
Yeah, like
he has a lot of her six qualities.
All right. Anything else you want to say about six before we move on to the enthusiast? Because, not to go back to Shauna the intern too often, but she did the Enneagram test. She went to the Enneagram Institute, spent the $12, and did the Enneagram test. And she came out her primary type, type seven, the enthusiast, the busy, fun-loving type, spontaneous, versatile, distractible, and scattered. And Oh, my goodness, this is my daughter. My daughter. If you look up Type 7, the enthusiast, it says, see Jesse. It is just ridiculous how this child. Now, a lot of people thought I was a 7.
Yes, because of your vocal patterns and the way you speak. You speak often like an enthusiast because you're being sort of high energy, upbeat, enthusiastic when you speak.
Coffee.
That's the commonality. But in terms of personality and motivation, not so much.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, Gail, take this baby home. Here we go. Type 7, the enthusiast, the busy, fun-loving, spontaneous, versatile, distractible, and scattered type, otherwise known as my daughter Jessie or Shauna the intern. Gail? We need the volume up. Sorry. Start again, Gail. Shauna the intern was a little distracted and scattered right there.
Distracted and scattered. Okay. So the real quality for the Type 7 enthusiast is joy and freedom. So how the 7 experiences that unity with divine essence is as being joyful, like the universe is just fresh and filled with new possibility and freedom, and the mind is freedom. There's this ever-changing newness. There's creativity and aliveness and wonder and spontaneity. And I feel, as a 7, that I am the openness of this vast limitlessness, right? The unboundedness, that optimizing dynamic thrust of the universe. It's all cooking and changing, and the universe is becoming, and I'm becoming, and there's this freedom, and everything is interesting and wonderful and just an experience to savor, and there are no limits to being. There's no. So when I lose that, when I lose presence, when I feel cut off from all that amazing, you know, optimizing flow of newness, I feel, as a 7, totally trapped, like locked up in the dark. I don't know how to find my way. I'm cut off from all the newness and the joy and the wonder and the possibility. And I feel like it's always going to be this way. I'm going to be trapped in this like quicksand, and I'm never going to get out. So the basic fear is of being trapped in emotional pain. I feel like I'm going to be cut off from the source of happiness. I'll be trapped without the light, you know, no way out. So the basic desire of the 7, what I want more than anything, what runs my personality, runs my life, I want to be happy. I want to be free. I want to be satisfied, and I want to be fulfilled. And particularly the idea of freedom, it's about having open-ended possibilities. Hmm. Being free is a key value to a 7. They cannot tolerate, you know, any kind of restriction or, you know, don't fence me in.
Does that impact their relationships?
Yes, it certainly does. They are often reluctant to get into any what might seem like a restrictive kind of relationship or job or even friendship. So sometimes people say, well, they're reluctant to commit, that they're commitment phobic. That's not the case. They can and do commit to lifelong relationships. However, they need to know before they commit and going into it that the person or even the friend or the job or the relationship that I'm committing to is going to allow me, in fact, encourage me, support me to be happy and free and satisfied and fulfilled, and is not going to try to, you know, tie me down and restrict me, because life is short, and as a 7, I've got a lot to do. And that famous one of the U.S. Founders, Thomas Jefferson, who helped write the U.S. Constitution, guaranteed that Type 7 value of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness right in our U.S. Constitution. Like, that was so important to him. Like, who'd ever thought of, you know, guaranteeing a people the pursuit of happiness? Only a 7 would think of that. Hmm. Thomas Jefferson, you know, thought about that. So at the healthy levels, these folks are very spontaneous. They love to have choices. They love to keep their options open. They can easily just move from thing to thing. They get inspired or stimulated or intrigued and creative, and they're flexible. They have lots of interests. Often they're very good at a lot of different things. They can change directions when needed. They tend to have, you know, that a quick mind. They tend to, not always, but a lot of times they do have a speech pattern of speaking very quickly, but their mind is very quick. and they can take up ideas very quickly. They can learn things, at least in a superficial way, you know, very quickly. They tend to be high energy, charming, impulsive, inspirational people, and they approach their life with a real curiosity and a sense of adventure. A lot of my best friends are sevens, and I love nothing more than to go off on a holiday, on an adventure, because I know it's going to be a real adventure, you know, if they're along. And now a little bit down the level, less healthy, more restricted, they can also be very self-centered, very irresponsible around all of this. Like, I just want what I want, and I want it now, and, you know, don't get in my way. So they can be, they hate this word, but often they're... Huge.
Millennials? Oh, sorry.
No, shallow
oh, okay.
people.
Right.
You know, dilettantes with a short attention span and not a lot of follow-through. One of the markers of a healthy seven is that they do have that follow-through, because an average seven loves beginnings, loves newness, loves new beginnings, loves to start new projects, new relationships, new jobs, new. But then they get, the B word is boredom, they get bored, and so they drop things. They can't follow through. But they tend to move easily into new experience. You know, they're open and friendly. It feels like the world is just exciting, pleasurable, endlessly, you know, fascinating place.
Okay, I, at the risk of, I don't know, talking about me, when you first met me and we started chatting, well, we haven't met, but, you know, when we first were chatting and communicating mm-hmm. with each other, you wondered if I was a seven, and then we figured out that I was actually a four.
Yes.
What's my
and again, it was based on how you sound, and
right.
part, because it's your job to be, well, and you are a fast talker,
yeah.
and you know, you do speak quickly, and you have an enthusiastic sort of, you know, lilt to your voice, and that's part of, you know, that's
But then I go job. Home and tank. I mean, I go...
That's right.
I go home and just sit in a rocking chair in the corner and drool, you know, and wonder how many people I offended and will I get fired, you know.
Yeah, so sevens never do that.
No.
They would never worry about who they offended. They, as I said, they're very, you know, high spirited. They can be quite brilliant. They can be Renaissance people. Also, they have this tremendous resiliency, like bounce back, you know, like a phoenix. They don't stay down for long. They have this almost unstoppable, you know, zest for life. And now, if they're healthy, they will go deeply into things. You know, they'll study something. They'll stick with it. But they have this, they're curious in breadth, you know, and for a healthy seven, that positivism is really genuine because they're realistic. But down the levels, less healthy, they tend to want to avoid all the difficult, unpleasant stuff. You know, they don't want
like
to think
chores.
About, well, chores. They don't. It's more emotional. They don't want to think about the pain in their lives. They particularly don't want to think about how they might be hurting other people, particularly with their insensitivity or their cavalier, you know, sort of attitude about things. They tend to, you know, they want to stay up, they want to stay high. They're the life of the party. That's sort of their energizer bunny. That's sort of their social role to keep the energy up and keep everybody happy and laughing and having fun. And when I'm doing that in at a party or at work or wherever, that helps me to stay up, because what I don't want as a seven is I don't want anybody to bring me down. Because when that happens, then I start thinking about the shadow stuff, the painful stuff inside. And as I said, I don't want to think about my own pain or how I'm causing other people's pain. So they generally want people around them who will help them stay up. Now, having said that, there's a real idealism in sevens. You know, they like to be the ambassadors of hope. They like to spread the light. They love to bring hope to people who don't have a lot of hope.
Okay, so hold on, I have to interject. When I'm in the dumps as a four, my daughter, a seven, an enthusiast, a 25-year-old who I wanted to just, you know, I would never do this, but slap upside the head when she was a 16-year-old irritating enthusiast who wouldn't do chores or follow through on things or just left a wake of destruction behind her as she walked through the house.
Uh-huh.
She is now the one who is infusing encouragement and light into my life.
Well, there you go. You just have to wait for it to mature.
Yeah, wait for it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, we've got to stop. We have to stop because we're out of time. But I want to leave the final wrap-up stuff with you, Gail. And before we do, no, actually, let me say what I'm going to say after you say what you're going to say. Can you say what you're going to say, and then I'll say what I'm going to say? Go.
What am I going to say?
I don't know. How do you want to wrap it up? How do you want to hit it and quit, Gail?
Well, I could tell you about one of my favorite Type 7 exemplars.
Oh, yeah.
Who happens to be the 14th Dalai Lama, the Tenzin Gyatso, very well-known.
The Dalai Lama is an enthusiast? I can't imagine the Dalai Lama walking through the living room leaving laundry behind him, like an extra sock or underwear on the ground.
Wait, got the one robe.
Oh, yeah.
That because he had a very particular upbringing, you know. But, you know, he's a spiritual leader. He's the head of the government in exile, you know, in India. But at age of, I think, age of two, right, when the Republic of China invaded Tibet. And then he was enthroned as the Dalai Lama at 15, I think it was. So, but if you think about his life, now a lot of people think, oh, he's probably a nine because he's all about peace. No.
Yeah, no.
What he's about is traveling all over the world and meeting people and smiling and lifting spirits and having adventures. He was the first Lama to travel to the West, right, to spread Buddhist teachings.
Lama.
And he, you know, he's always about, you know, participating fully in that dynamic unfolding of reality. And he's joyous and his heart lights up and people want to be around him because, and think about the burden that he has to carry. I mean, what has happened over the decades to the people in his homeland. But he's always got a smile. He's always got a happy word. He talks about and writes about, you know, finding true peace is about being happy and loving kindness and spreading happiness in the world.
Yep.
But he's a true seven.
Just a second. I just thought of something. Oh, wait a second. I'd like to go back to me for a minute. I just remembered I had someone, how do I say this? A daughter of a good friend of mine came and lived with us when we were in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And she ended up getting really ticked off with who I was as a person because she saw hypocrisy. And what she saw was she knew me as a seven. She thought I was a seven, an enthusiast.
Okay.
But because she was living with me, she saw me come home and tank.
Yeah.
And then I would go out and I would have the light on and the sparkle or whatever. And she just saw that as hypocritical. And she told me that.
Well, you know, there's a very simple answers for things like that with the Enneagram. For one thing, a type seven, they generally are extroverts, which means that how they recharge their energy is through people, through interaction with other people. So they're getting fed by being, in energetic situations with transfer of energy and being around people, fun and laughter and everything. So a four, however, is a withdrawn type and generally an introvert, which means that you can tolerate a certain amount of being around other people and being the life of pulling the energy, but then you go back to your fallback, you know, temperament, which is I want to be alone, I want to look within, I want to think about me, and don't bother me, you know. So we always sort of go back to, you know, we're one way on stage or on air or at work, but the qualities of our natural temperament will take over, and you as an introverted type four, withdrawn type four.
As a sucky dramatic four, yes.
As a sucky dramatic, I didn't say that. Need that alone time, need to go within, need to recharge that way.
I really, really, I don't want to sound creepy, but I really like you. And you have been more of a blessing in my life. Well, no, I think you have. You have an idea. You should probably have an idea by now of what a legit blessing you have been in my life. I'm so happy to have met you, Gail. Thank you for the investment, the personal investment that you have you've been in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that you have many in your life who have done as much. If not way more than what you've done for me. Did I say that right? What I'm trying to say is I like you. Thanks for helping me be less of a jerk.
Thank you so much. My pleasure. It's always fun.
Yeah, thank you from us, too, for him being less of a jerk.
Oh, stop. Would you turn his mic off, please? Jeez. So Gail Scott, Master Enneagram Teacher and Consultant, Founder and Director of the Enneagram Mystery School in Boulder, Colorado. If you want to email her, her email address is public. Freak. Gail Scott, GAYLESCOTT, Gail Scott @comcast.net, and it is posted on her bio on our site, on today's show. So you can go there, click on it, and send her a note, ask for help. She does offer courses, et cetera, et cetera, training. You can bring her up to Canada or to wherever you live around the world. Pay her enough, she'll fly anywhere. Gail, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Take care. Yeah, bye. Gail Scott. Ooh, man, so much good stuff in this. I've had some great conversations with people recently about the Enneagram, and it's just been gold. And the more you learn, the more you grow. Because it's so palatable, it almost feels like it's really smart stuff dumbed down for people that are aware of their own skid marks.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
No.
Because the Myers-Briggs is, I contrasted with that a lot because a lot of people know about the Myers-Briggs. Yeah. But the Myers-Briggs for me was always like, oh, business people and leadership and how to be better and, that stuff didn't really mean anything to me because I don't care about succeeding.
Yeah. Obviously.
But it also, it didn't point out the shadow side of yourself, the skid marks, as I like to call it. And the Enneagram is so good at pointing out those things. I was going to think of another analogy, but it really is good at sort of showing the shadow side of your ego agenda.
Absolutely.